Support for On Point and the following message come from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Home plays a big role in your life. That's why Quicken Loans created Rocket Mortgage. It lets you apply simply and understand the entire mortgage process fully, so you can be confident that you're getting the right mortgage for you. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/onpoint.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. Blue tarps instead of roofs on tens of thousands of homes in Puerto Rico. 150,000 still without power. Tens of thousands more leaving the island looking for stability and a new life on the mainland. And it's been almost 6 months. 6 months since Hurricane Maria devastated the island and made it impossible to ignore that Puerto Rico's economy was already in profound trouble. Yet the island's government has put out what seems to be an oddly optimistic economic forecast. Why? This hour On Point, a reality check and what Puerto Rico's recovery will really take. You can join us on air or online. Are your friends and family in Puerto Rico still struggling to get by? Or did they receive the help they need? Did they have to move out? Are you one of the Puerto Ricans who's looked for stability and a better life here on the mainland? Do you wish you could go back? You can join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. And just to note, a little bit later this hour, President Trump has released his school safety plan. Ideas include hardening schools and arming some school officials. So later in the show, we will talk about that. But first, let's go to Puerto Rico. And joining me now from San Juan is Omaya Sosa Pascual, a journalist and founder of Puerto Rico's Center for Investigative Journalism. Her organization is actually suing Puerto Rico's demographic registry for not providing statistical updates on the death count following the hurricane. We've got links to her work at onpointradio.org. Omaya, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Meghna, I have to say that right, Meghna. Thanks for having us.
I'm very glad to have you, and thank you. I mean, first of all, can you just describe what it's like there on the island to this day, 6 months later? I mean, have things improved or not?
Well, you know, things have improved. There's some power in many places. I say some because when you receive the statistics, it means you have power, but it can go away a couple of times a week, for example, or a month. So it's still very unreliable. The same thing with water. We're still driving with most of the traffic lights that are not working. So it's still a daily challenge for many people. And we're still not talking about those 150,000 homes or businesses, I must say. It's not people. Homes or businesses that have no power at all. So that means it's almost 500,000 persons without electricity that are still living in very difficult conditions. So I'm really talking about the cities. In the cities, things are better.
Well, so, I mean, Omaya, though, even if you say in the cities things are better, to hear descriptions such as functioning traffic lights are kind of hit and miss really sort of brings it, it makes it real in terms of the day-to-day challenges that Puerto Ricans are still facing. How much worse then are things in mountainous smaller towns?
It's still crazy. It's a daily challenge for everybody, but it's our new reality. People tell me, how can you live like this? But you know, you have no other choice. You get used to it, and it's made me at least see a very positive new side of what Puerto Ricans are all about. We're actually quite civilized people. I wasn't expecting that. You know, we're all being kind to each other, and it's surprising how we can move forward every day working without stoplights almost anywhere.
Yeah.
So, you know, but in the mountains, it's definitely much worse. You know, living without power, and I myself lived without power for more than 3 months. Mm. It's almost impossible.
Yeah.
Getting a diesel for your power generator, if you're lucky enough to have one. It's all kinds of perils you have to confront every day.
Okay. So, I mean, we have a comment on our website from Ray in Vermont, and Ray writes, I spoke to a woman this weekend who's from San Juan. She said that they were without power for nearly 3 months in her neighborhood, and that's pretty amazing for a reasonably populous area of a part of the United States. That's 6 months later, and there are still tens of thousands without power. It's a bit staggering. I wouldn't say a bit.
I'd say, you know, it's you can't process it. It's really incomprehensible.
Mm. So, Omaya, tell me about the Puerto Ricans who are leaving, who feel that their future isn't necessarily on the island. I mean, have you spoken with many of them, and what impact is that having?
You see it every day, and we still don't have clear demographics on who these people are. From what I see on the ground, it's all kinds of people. You have poor people, you have rich people, you have professionals, you have middle-class blue-collar workers. It's today we got actually the newest numbers, and it's 184,000 people that officially left only in September, October, and November.
184,000 people in just 3 months?
Correct. Those numbers are fresh from today.
Now, and are these Puerto Ricans who have families? Are they young? Are they sort of the heart of what the Puerto Rican economy should be, or who are they?
That's what I'm saying. We don't have clear demographics yet for everybody, but I think there's a mix of many kinds of people. You have very old people that cannot stand the situation here, that maybe have family in the States and are moving with their family members so they can be taken care of and get health care, for example, and so forth. But you have a lot of professionals and working, just regular working class people that just can't find a job.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, people in the States talk a lot about the electricity and those kind of problems, which are obviously make daily living very difficult. But I would say that the biggest tragedy right now is the economy and how people, you know, the power situation has led to tens, hundreds of thousands of people without jobs because most local businesses had to close.
Yeah.
And a lot of also multinational companies have had to close or downsize. And that's the biggest problem right now.
Right. Omaya, let me just jump in here because I want to get a caller who has a thought on exactly this point. Felix is calling from Atlanta, Georgia. You're on the air, Felix. Felix, are you there?
I'm here. Can you hear me?
I can hear you now. What's your thought?
Hi, Meghna. Yes, I left Puerto Rico after Irma and Maria. I arrived here in Atlanta about a month after. But prior to the storms, prior to the hurricanes, I was already planning on leaving just due to the economic, you know, troubles on the island. What Maria and Irma did was basically magnify and accelerate, you know, the problems that the island was having.
Mm. Felix, thank you so much for your call. I want to bring in another voice into this conversation. Bianca Padro Ocasio, she joins us from Orlando, Florida. She's a breaking news reporter for the Orlando Sentinel, and she's been covering the Puerto Rican evacuees living in Florida. We're talking, you know, Omaya just told us that in a period of 3 months, 185,000 Puerto Ricans left the island for the mainland. Bianca, welcome to On Point.
Thank you for having me.
So tell me, I mean, you've been covering this story carefully. What are the kinds of things that Puerto Ricans are telling you about the difficult decision they're making to permanently relocate?
Sure. And it's very tragic. And a lot of I'm Puerto Rican myself, but I've been living in the States for a few years now. And just seeing it's not just the financial burden on these families, but also the emotional one. The fact that after the hurricane, many people just packed up and left, and many of them left their destroyed homes in the same conditions, you know, just taking what they could with them. And like Omaya was saying, some people have come here because they have family members who are living in Central Florida, because we know we have a sizable Puerto Rican population here. But a lot of people are coming here and they don't have any family. They don't have any friends. They kind of started out by staying at hotels with FEMA aid, and maybe have gotten extensions, have tried to find jobs. But I think the biggest problem is that most people did not expect for the recovery to be taking this long.
Yeah.
So while some families were saying, you know, oh, we're going to go and we're going to stay there for a couple of months and then we're going to go back. And that's what I was hearing when I used to go to the airport right after the hurricane and kind of talk to people who were just getting here from Puerto Rico. And what they were saying was, you know, we're just going to feel it out and see what happens and hopefully go back and go back to our lives, go back to our jobs. But that has dramatically changed in the past couple of months, because now the tone that you're hearing is, you know, well, I have to start learning English. I have to start, you know, finding a more stable job, finding a more permanent home here and building a life. And what you're going to start seeing is that these families that really had no plans to just stay here for the long term will have to build their lives here.
Mm. And what effect is that going to have on Puerto Rico itself? Because I'm seeing that there are some estimates, and this may be sort of on the extreme edge, that, you know, 5 to 10% of the population could choose to leave the island permanently in the next couple of years. And, you know, there's some analysts who say it's kind of akin to the exodus of Irish immigrants during the potato famine there. I mean, does that sound wildly out of line with what you're seeing in Florida?
I think my perspective here is that, and I saw those numbers, comparisons with Ireland, and I think there's just a lot of anger and mistrust in the local government in Puerto Rico and to a certain extent to the federal government. So I think that you will see those numbers grow, and if the recovery, and I think Omaya can speak more to this because of what's happening on the ground, but jobs are a big issue in Puerto Rico, and they have been for years now. I mean, people are coming here because they're trying to find better economic opportunities that they probably didn't have on the island. And even after the hurricane, you know, maybe many people lost their jobs. And from what we're hearing here, they lost them because the resources weren't available. There just wasn't a market for smaller businesses. They lost a huge clientele. So I think those numbers, we don't have any set demographics or numbers yet, but
yeah,
from those that came out today, just in those 3 months, it's staggering.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, even Florida was not prepared for that. And even those early numbers that we were hearing, there's even a housing issue here. So you're seeing those families coming, and I think that it's going to keep growing.
Well, so there's obviously a profound and ongoing ripple effect here. So when we come back from the break, we're going to talk about exactly what it's going to take to get the island back on its feet and what's stopping that from happening. I'm joined by Bianca Padro Ocasio and Omaya Sosa Pascual. We're talking about a reality check in Puerto Rico. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
Support for On Point and the following message come from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Chances are you're confident when it comes to your work, your hobbies, and your life. Rocket Mortgage gives you that same level of confidence when it comes to buying a home or refinancing your existing home loan. Rocket Mortgage is simple, allowing you to fully understand all the details and be confident you're getting the right mortgage for you. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/onpoint. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states. NMLSconsumeraccess.org, number 3030.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking about a reality check when it comes to Puerto Rico. And since it's been almost 6 months after Hurricane Maria really devastated the island, what's it going to take to get Puerto Rico back on its feet? Follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. Let's hear a little bit of sound from a Puerto Rican. Her name is Nicole Bonilla. She lost her job as a nurse after the hurricane caused the hospital where she worked to close. Now she volunteers bringing aid to people who live in the more rural parts of the island. And she told NBC News last month, they do need more help.
We saw a lot of help in the beginning, but every time I talk to someone that is like high in the mountains, they say they haven't seen anyone to help them. We are trying to do our best, but I think we might need a little bit of help.
Well, I'm joined today by Omaya Sosa Pascual. She's a journalist and founder of Puerto Rico's Center for Investigative Journalism. She joins us from San Juan. And by Bianca Padro Ocasio. She's a breaking news reporter for the Orlando Sentinel, joining us from Orlando. Let's get a quick call in here. Rick is calling from Hyde Park, Massachusetts. You're on the air, Rick.
Hi, Magna.
Hi. You're on the air.
Hi. Yeah, so I just wanted to comment. I just actually just came back from Puerto Rico last week. right before the nor'easter here, and that was my first time visiting. I'm of Puerto Rican descent. My my mother and father are from Puerto Rico, and it is still pretty rough out there. I don't have a really good reference as to what the island looked like before, but it, from what I've seen, it's still pretty rough. Like your speaker said, the traffic lights, at least half of them, if not most of them, are inoperable. The roads are terrible. There are huge, huge potholes that destroy people's cars. A week before that, my mom, she's there right now, and she went to visit a relative, and they were out in the south southwest, like Aguadilla, Moca area, and they're elderly, and they haven't seen any real assistance. That no one checks up on them. Uh-huh. She went, they had no water. She had to go get them water. She bought them 10 gallons of water, just for the next few days or the week or so. And it's still pretty rough.
Rick, thank you so much for your call. And I hope that that your family, gets by as well as they can, given the circumstances. Omaya Sosa Pascual, you have written extensively on the Puerto Rican government's central role in how it seems as if its central role in the challenges in getting Puerto Rico to a state of full recovery. I mean, what's going on here? Is the government not fully honest with its finances?
You know what? It's many things. It's not. It's a divided responsibility between the Puerto Rican government and the federal government. Mm-hmm. I was going to comment on some of the things that the nurse that you put on the air said, and the caller, Felix. First of all, very quickly, I do think it's very possible that we lose 5 to 10% of the population. So it's not unthinkable to believe that. That's what we're seeing on the ground. 6 months without power, the situation was bad before. As Felix said, before Maria, we were losing yearly 50,000 persons to the economic crisis. So you can imagine, this 184,000 in 3 months is 6% of the population already. Yes. So it's not unthinkable to what these people are saying that will happen in the long run.
Okay, so Omaya, since you mentioned that there were already major challenges, economic challenges, before these two hurricanes hit the island, then I definitely want to talk about the federal government's role in all this, but you've written really extensively about the Puerto Rican government, right? They just recently, a little earlier this year, came out with a fiscal plan that the central government says is going to chart the future of the country. But in your analysis, you say that that very plan is built on economic projections that are totally incompatible with the historical experience of regions that have gone through hurricanes the world over. So are they not being totally forthright in the capacity that Puerto Rico does not have right now?
Correct. They really aren't being forthright, and that's the problem the Puerto Rican government has had for decades now. And it's unbelievable they're still putting out these projections. But the thing is that it's not only the Puerto Rican government. In that story, we also talk about our situation with the control board, the fiscal control board, or the oversight board that is right now overseeing Puerto Rico's finances, and that's a creature of the Congress. And they're putting out the crazy projections, too.
Yeah.
So, both are playing this game that is unbelievable.
Yeah, I mean, I'm sorry to jump in, but there does seem to be a completely bizarre disconnect, right? Because here we are talking about how, as you see it on the ground, it is entirely realistic for 6 or 10% of the population of Puerto Rico to permanently leave the island. But on the other hand, we have these government reports that are also in defiance of Puerto Rico's historical trajectory over the past several decades. I mean, you've written that the economy there has never reached the annual growth projections that the government itself is projecting for 2019. I mean, how can people have faith that both the government in Puerto Rico and the federal government will be good stewards of the future of this island if they can't even be realistic about where the island's lack of economic capacity right now?
There is absolutely no faith, no faith at all. And it's really an impossible situation because we've analyzed it also in other stories. And basically the legal responsibility of everything, the operation of the Puerto Rican government is local. It's the government of Puerto Rico. But the power, the resources, and the requirements are in the federal government. So you have somebody with no resources and basically no real power, legally responsible of everything here. And that's the game that has been going on for the past 6 months. The caller that went in, the last one, said that, you know, that not all the aid has been getting here, that things look pretty bad. And also the nurse was really kind, saying a lot of aid came in the beginning. Well, that's actually not true. We still don't have the line of credit
right. That
was supposed to arrive here, and it's been 6 months. So I think we've gotten from the CDBG funds only maybe $1.5 billion.
Yeah.
And most of the aid package will arrive in 2019, they say. Why?
Right. Well, I want to actually just play a bit of tape here to the point you're making right now. This is San Juan Mayor Carmen Cruz. She told Al Jazeera earlier this month that the federal government's response in her eyes has been totally inadequate and there have been consequences.
We have been granted $4.9 billion in a loan by the government of the United States. We haven't gotten one single cent of that loan. So we are looking at, in the next months, a deepening of a social crisis that was there before Maria, but that definitely was widened and much more aggressive after Maria.
Now, the FEMA is actually saying that one of the reasons why it's withholding funds so far is that it says it, in a letter that it wrote, that Puerto Rico has about $1.7 billion in liquidity, despite island leaders saying that it's going to run out of cash. And FEMA says the funds will be provided when the Commonwealth Central cash balance decreases to a certain level. So it's hard to really know who's being totally straight here on the financial situation with Puerto Rico.
And in the end, the people are stuck in the middle with the humanitarian situation,
yes.
Serious humanitarian situation. You know, it's true. The local government has a lot of transparency problems and a lot of just management problems, but we knew that before the hurricanes. That's why the Congress set up that board. So, I mean, why is FEMA surprised about this? Why is FEMA not giving them? They should look for a mechanism.
Six months
of people, you know, having water problems. It's just unacceptable.
Right.
Find some other way, you know?
Maya, hang on here for a second, just because I want to bring Bianca Padro Ocasio back into the conversation. Bianca, thank you for your patience here, but I was just wondering if you had a response to the things that you're hearing Omaya saying about sort of a lack of good faith that she sees both on the part of the island's government and the federal government as well.
I think she absolutely brings up a valid point about, you know, the local government had these issues even before the hurricane. And it's interesting seeing the conversation and how people are putting a lot of emphasis on, you know, this aid that hasn't arrived, because that's true. And this is something that the federal government should have a huge active role in. And I think that as long as, you know, what we're hearing from the local government and the response and some things that really took a long time and contracts that were botched and that kind of thing, those are good points. But at the end of the day, this aid that should be overseen and was overseen for Texas, was overseen for Florida after Hurricane Irma, but it was not done in the same way for Puerto Rico. And
yeah.
I think that that's a valid point, because the you know, FEMA itself, we've seen reports coming out of you know, these boxes of food that never arrived. Here in Florida, we reported how, you know, there were these housing extensions that were never granted to people who they had to then appeal. And this process, I mean, this takes weeks, and these are people's lives. So
mm-hmm.
you end up having people, we've heard here, people living in cars. They are, some of them living in shelters. And these are people who came here for a better life and trying to flee those conditions on the island.
Yeah.
And when you have that kind of, those delays in federal aid that are not getting to people, that's a problem, and it takes a toll on people's
uh-huh.
abilities to find jobs and to find stability.
Well, let me bring one more voice into the conversation here. Justin Velez-Hagan is founder and executive director of the National Puerto Rican Chamber of Commerce. He joins us from Washington. Justin, welcome to On Point.
Hello, Meghna.
Thank you for your patience as well, because there's so much to discuss here. I mean, I'm interested in hearing from all of you. And Justin, I'm going to start with you about where should we be focusing our efforts right now in terms of trying to get past these major problems that Omaya and Bianca have been talking about? Where would you target your efforts?
Well, that's an extremely tough question, and this is something our organization deals with on the daily. On the one hand, we get certainly tons of emails literally saying, I beg you for assistance. And these are from people in the mountains, from different parts of the island. And we send tons of cash, tons of assistance, tons of people, volunteers down there. We set up our own private sector supply chain to help these people as much as possible, because we know that the government can't do all the work, even if they wanted to. But on the other hand, we see that there is money out there. There is money flowing. The government of Puerto Rico actually said it might have about $7 billion on cash at hand. At least this is something they present to the Fiscal Oversight Board. But there's a little political interplay there that people aren't really paying a lot of attention to, that's kind of creating this contradictory environment. Whereas on the one hand, they want to present a rosy fiscal picture to the Fiscal Oversight Board. They don't want it to be too rosy. Because they don't necessarily want austerity measures to be forced upon them, to cut back their own spending, to cut back pensions, to cut back other forms of assistance to the island that they deem is necessary at this point, that could further exacerbate the economic conditions. So it's a tough environment, that's for sure.
Omaya Sosa Pascual, respond to that. I mean,
I totally agree. And that brings, there's another very strong player, probably the strongest one, that is the bankruptcy court. They are the ones who are going to decide in the end what's going to happen. And everything they say, everything that the local government says or does, everything the board, the fiscal board says or does, it goes into play with the lawsuit of the bondholders, and who are fighting, you know, for their share in the public debt. So, and you know, everything they're writing, and that's from our story, the fantasy of the fiscal plan, says that even though everything in Puerto Rico is supposed to be subjected to that plan, the reignition of economy and so forth, it really means nothing, because in the end, at some point in the next month, the court is going to decide really how much money is going to the bondholders, and everything that will just you know, throw the plan down the drain.
Yeah. So, Justin Velez-Hagan, what's your response to that?
Sure. No, that's 100% correct. Yeah. I mean, they are the overhand that's overseeing all the budget, the fiscal policies that are going to be enacted in Puerto Rico. And if you don't appease them or make them happy, then they can implement some of those austerity measures. They can do any number of things they could.
But they're there because of what many people see as rampant financial mismanagement on the behalf of the Puerto Rican government, or by the Puerto Rican government, before the hurricanes even.
You're 100% right. I do not mean to speak negatively of them, because I think that they have a very strong purpose. A couple of reasons. I think there's been a lot of ineptitude in Puerto Rico that has led to the current crisis. That's 100%. I'm certain of that. But also there's a lot of corruption that even the governor himself can't necessarily control.
Yeah. Justin, let me just jump in here, because I've got a caller, Jake, from Lynn, Massachusetts, who wants to talk about his view of the Puerto Rican government. Jake, you're on the air.
Yes. Hi, Meghna. I was in Puerto Rico before, and I went out on the first commercial flight to Puerto Rico after the hurricane. And I've been going back and forth because some family members and property over there. And what you're seeing is the incompetence of the government to be able to manage money responsibly. I feel, this is my own personal opinion, they should not get a single dime to manage themselves. That money, whatever money that they get, it should be managed by some appointee federal agency, but never to be given to the Puerto Rican government.
Yeah, Jake, thank you so much for your call. I'm going to jump in here because I want to turn that back to Omaya. You hear how little faith Jake has in the Puerto Rican government.
I told you, there's no faith. And you know what's the problem? It's true and totally founded that the Puerto Rico government has mismanaged things here for a long time. But I have to say, the board is mismanaging money too. They've been, they just were reprimanded by the court, bankruptcy court, because they're spending $77 million in lawyers. okay?
Mm-hmm.
And we're being overcharged. So, you know, the board is not being very transparent too. And then we have FEMA, who is awarding these bogus contracts. I don't know if you saw the one in the New York Times, $130 million to bring food here.
Yep.
That was never got here. So, I mean, the three elements are just doing a terrible job, and the people are in the middle. I have to bring up one other element, which I think in the end is the most important one. The political situation in Puerto Rico, the colonial situation in Puerto Rico is in the end the biggest problem we have, because nobody is accountable, nobody's in charge, and we have no voting power.
Yeah.
The citizens cannot even complain and cannot even claim, go to Congress and, you know, make their rights worthwhile. It's crazy, and nobody's talking about that.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're getting a reality check on Puerto Rico almost 6 months after Hurricane Maria. Justin Velez-Hagan, just before the break, Omaya Sosa Pascual was talking about sort of a fundamental lack of representation that she sees Puerto Ricans as having that really makes it harder for them to advocate for the things that would help get the island back on its feet. Just what's your response to that?
No, that's very true. If you don't have your own voices in Congress, they have a voice, but they don't have a voting voice, then you have to somehow find champions. You have to find maybe a Marco Rubio or someone out there who tends to be on your side and is willing to express your voice or has a number of constituents that are somehow tied to Puerto Rico. And that's difficult to find. Marco Rubio is a decent one because he has so many constituents in Puerto Rico, but he doesn't represent Puerto Rico. He represents Florida. And there are a lot of Floridians who have policy interests that are contrary to those that will benefit Puerto Rico.
Mm. Well, we've got a lot of callers who want to join us, so let's see if we can get at least a couple of them into the conversation. Grace is calling from Montreal, Quebec. You're on the air, Grace.
Yes, hello. Hi. I just came back from Puerto Rico about 2 days ago and witnessed several things, one of which was flooding on the north coast where we had a house in Atillo, which is on the northwestern coast of Puerto Rico. And I find that, and also I spent some time inland as well in the mountains, saw that the roads were actually quite good, but the electric lines seem to be precariously strung just through these really sort of jagged high mountain ridges, and that seems to be an issue.
Yeah.
Also, I noted that we weren't even sure if we would have electricity when we went down there in our area because, as the landlord said, they had electricity and then it went out. There was a small power station that was blown out, and it was going to take 6 weeks for them to get one little box that would restore electricity.
Still,
and
wow.
I just find it, I find it remarkable that, I mean, that should take like 3 days, right?
Yeah.
I mean,
Grace, I'm going to just jump in here because I appreciate you sort of giving us your view of what you just saw a couple of days ago in Puerto Rico, but I want to get another caller in here. Rick is calling from St. Thomas, Virgin Islands. You're on the air, Rick.
Hi, Magna. Thanks for calling, taking my call. The conversation so far has been right on. I've lived 23 years here in St. Thomas, which is about 45 miles from Puerto Rico. Today's front page of the Virgin Island paper said that we are finally totally restored here in St. Thomas.
Oh, that's good news,
but,
at least.
Puerto Rico's, I went 4 months myself without power. But the flight from Puerto Rico and actually from the Virgin Islands, here in the Virgin Islands, all the rich people are gone, all the educated people. Our private school is 50%. Our Montessori school is one-third. Everybody's leaving if they can.
Oh, Rick, thank you so much for your call. First of all, thanks for the little glimmer of good news from St. Thomas. But Bianca Padro Ocasio, to Rick's larger point, I mean, he's seeing some of the most educated people leave. Are you seeing that in terms of who's coming to Florida?
Well, you know, like Omaya said earlier, it's such a mix of people and demographics. And I actually wanted to go back to a previous point about kind of the political leverage that we're seeing from people who are leaving the island. And earlier this year in January, we saw that the governor of Puerto Rico, Ricardo Rosselló, he came here to Kissimmee and you know, basically had some sort of political rally and called for this political organization and people to come together and vote against the candidates who have voted against against the interests of Puerto Rico. And he actually called by name, not in that event, but previously, Senator Marco Rubio for voting, for this tax bill that he argued had some measures that were against the island. But, you know, we haven't really seen that come to fruition. And quite frankly, a lot of people that I've spoken to, they're not even thinking of registering to vote right now because of these other problems that are very valid that they're facing. And I think that, you know, it's not just, we're seeing a lot of headlines. And in the wake of the hurricane, we saw a lot of headlines. Oh, you know, Puerto Ricans are going to be a huge voting bloc. But we haven't seen that necessarily people going out in droves to register to vote, because one factor is that the political system here on the mainland is different than the one in Puerto Rico, starting with the fact that in Puerto Rico, we don't vote for in the presidential election. And there's not that clear divide between Democrat and Republicans. That political division is completely different on the island. So that's just to say that we're seeing a lot of these headlines and kind of these speculation of what it means that so many Puerto Ricans have come here after the hurricane. But in the end, Puerto Ricans are not stupid. I mean, they know that they are overlooked by the federal government, that they are living that reality right now. And this is, I agree with Amaya that this is partly because of that colonial situation that Puerto Rico has been in for, you know, centuries.
Well, Amaya Sosa Pascual, let me turn back to you here, because I want to actually get a sense from you. We just got a couple minutes to go here in terms of the practical next steps that still need to be taken in Puerto Rico, because you've written about how the administration of Governor Rosselló, you believe their plan really just is relying too much on promised monies from the federal government. But if not that, then what?
I would love to answer that question, and we really don't know. It's very troubling. We have no idea what it will be, and I have to go back to the colonial situation. So people in the mainland understand the seriousness of it. It's not a political thing. It goes right to the heart of our economic situation. A lot of decisions that affect us are made on the mainland, and that affect our economy are made by Congress. And example, the Jones Act. Everything we receive is by sea, mostly by sea and by air, but food. And it costs us 20% more just because of this primitive law that makes everything has to be shipped by U.S. Flag boats. And we also have what just happened after Maria, the tax reform. We were stuck with the foreign countries. Why? For some things, we are U.S.-based, and for other things, we are considered a foreign territory. So all the imports get a 12.5% extra tax now. So the companies, the U.S. companies that were here, have no incentive to remain here in the middle of the critical economic situation we have. So, it's we don't know what's going to happen.
Yeah.
We're stuck begging maybe other senators and representatives to try and make a case for us. And like it's proven with the recent tax reform, always unsuccessful.
Right. So, but Omaya, again, your points about the federal government and its view of Puerto Rico are well taken. We just got a few seconds here, though. I do want you to just tell me for a moment, though, Governor Rosselló says he's going to do some structural reforms and find savings in government spending on the island. I mean, where would that be?
I think the board is going to, in the end, the board and the bankruptcy court are going to take control. You know, in the end, they're going to say this fiscal plan, it's not no good here and there. March 30th, the board is supposed to certify the plan or put forward their own plan. And they're already talking about reducing the pensions of the people here in Puerto Rico.
Yeah.
And, in the end, also the board, in a lot of senses, responds to bondholders.
Right.
They're trying to defend. So for the regular citizen, it's we really don't know what's going to happen. I think we're going to get very impoverished, more even so than what we are right now.
Omaya Sosa Pascual, thank you for the sobering but honest assessment on the amount of uncertainty that Puerto Ricans are still facing today. She's a journalist and founder of Puerto Rico Center for Investigative Journalism, joining us from San Juan. Omaya, thank you so much.
For having me, Magna.
And Bianco Padro Ocasio with the Orlando Sentinel, joining us from Orlando as well. Bianca, thank you so much.
It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
And Justin Velez-Hagan, with the founder and executive director of the National Puerto Rican Chamber of Commerce. I feel like we just scratched the surface here, but I do appreciate your time.
Next time, we'll come back to it.
We will. Thank you. Well, in a moment, we'll talk about President Trump's new school safety plan. This is On Point. The White House has announced its school safety plan, and it fulfills some promises that President Trump has made, but backs away from others. It released the plan just yesterday, and joining me from New York is Lois Beckett, senior reporter for The Guardian, covering gun policy, criminal justice, and the far right. We can find a link to her story. It's headlined, Trump Plans to Arm Teachers, but drops pledge on gun purchase age limit. That link is at onpointradio.org. Lois, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Magna.
Hi. So first of all, describe to us what specifically is in the president's school safety plan.
So the plan that was released last night and discussed by White House officials does include moving forward on a plan to provide some federal support for giving teachers and other school staff firearms training. We haven't got any specifics on how much money will be devoted to that. The White House said that existing Justice Department funds meant to help local jurisdictions would be used to help teachers get firearms training with local law enforcement officials. So that, of course, is probably the most controversial part of the plan.
Let me just jump in here, actually, for a second, because Education Secretary Betsy DeVos was speaking about this very point today. She was on today's Savannah Guthrie. She struggled a little to explain the specifics around these new policies when Guthrie asked DeVos if teachers should be allowed to carry weapons.
I don't think an assault weapons in schools carried by any school personnel is the appropriate thing. But again, this is an issue that I think is best decided at the local level by communities and by states.
But a student could legally carry an assault weapon, a student over 18.
Not in schools, they can't.
Okay, so you still want the schools to be gun-free zones, except for the teachers?
I think schools have to be protected like every other large gathering place.
So Lois Beckett, I mean, there was some uncertainty there in terms of what Secretary DeVos was saying. I mean, how clear is the plan on this issue?
We haven't gotten a lot of details on the plan. Basically, what the White House has said is that there are existing state and local programs to allow some school personnel to carry guns within the schools, to carve out exceptions under federal law to allow them to do that, and that they want to sort of build on what some states are already doing. It's just such a striking fact of the American gun control debate that this whole issue is being discussed around arming schools.
Mm-hmm.
The fact that the Secretary of Education is now talking about whether or not teachers or students would be carrying military-style rifles within public schools, I mean, this is something that the rest of the world is looking at and saying, what are Americans doing? How is this even possible?
Right. And I mean, that gets to the other part of the plan that's actually not there in terms of keeping certain weapons out of the hands of certain people, because the president had talked about advocating raising the buying age to 21. I mean, back in February, he said the NRA will back it. Florida decided to make that move, and the NRA is suing the state of Florida. This part of Trump's previous proposals is not in the plan.
Even as early as Sunday morning, White House spokesman Maj Shah was saying that age limits were going to be part of this forthcoming plan. But what we saw is that for weeks, Trump and the NRA were opposed on this issue, and Trump said that the NRA would back away on this. And instead, it's the president who has backed away, saying that he's going to wait and see how this lawsuit turns out before he acts on age limits for gun purchases. It's also noteworthy that the president tweeted this morning that there just wasn't a lot of political support for this policy. That is not the case. Recent polls have shown that a majority of American adults, 67%, 71%, support raising the age for all gun purchases to 21. So there is a lot of public support, but there's not support from the NRA, and the president is backing off.
I mean, so from the parts of the plan that you're describing that are there and those that are not, I mean, it sounds like an NRA-approved school safety plan.
There are elements of it that really do have broader backing from gun violence prevention experts. Probably the most significant part of the plan from that perspective is that the president endorsed the creation of extreme risk protection orders. So this would give law enforcement or family members a way to petition a court and say, this person is really unstable, they're high risk, they shouldn't own guns right now. And that's a policy that was developed by scientists and mental health experts 5 years ago after Sandy Hook. It has widespread support among gun violence prevention groups, including Sandy Hook Promise, an organization that represents some of the families from Sandy Hook. Different states, California, Washington, Oregon, have pushed this policy forward in recent years. So it's a real win for science to have the president endorse that. He's not pushing Congress, he's pushing on the states, but this will potentially give Republicans at the state level cover to come behind this measure, which really could have a real effect on saving lives.
Right. So help me understand a little bit more, because there seems to be some confusion about what the Trump administration's stance is on whether certain issues around gun safety in schools should be dealt with at the state level or at the federal level, right? Because, for example, with the age limit question, as you've reported, the president, you know, he's not taking on that issue head on anymore, but instead assigning that to a new federal commission on school safety chaired by Secretary DeVos. But just a second ago, we heard DeVos say, well, a lot of these questions should be, you know, hashed out by the states.
Last night, different White House officials repeatedly said, as the president has said, there's been too much talk on this issue. It's time for action. But the action that the White House is taking is creating a federal commission to talk about this stuff some more and punting a lot of the most controversial issues, including age limits, to this commission, which is, of course, the opposite of taking action. It is, in fact, just engaging in more talk. On Saturday night, the president was at a rally in Pennsylvania, mocked the idea of blue ribbon commissions as an approach to dealing with drug abuse, and yet the White House is coming forward and saying for school shootings, this is the path we want to take. So the president is clearly feeling the pressure from the public and from the students in Florida to really do something, but isn't living up to that. Those promises is really trying to delay on a lot of fronts.
So we've got about a minute left here, Lois. Help me understand, how much of this is actually binding or you see as could be potentially effective? Because as you're saying a little bit earlier, it's not clear how much any of these proposals will cost. And the Justice Department is saying it's going to use money already budgeted within the DOJ.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of questions around that. And certainly one of the other policies that the president had endorsed and then backed away from was actually closing loopholes in the background check system. Instead, he decided to only endorse the mildest possible compromise in Congress, which is to, you know, ask states and federal agencies to follow existing law. So again, big talk on making steps forward, but in fact, just going with the most minimal viable product.
Well, Lois Beckett is senior reporter for The Guardian, covering gun policy, criminal justice, and the far right in the United States. She's walking us through the school safety plan unveiled by the Trump administration just last night. We've got a link to her reporting on that at onpointradio.org. Lois Beckett, thank you so very much.
Thanks.
And listeners, thank you for sticking with me. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.